Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
Today on the podcast, we talk with Joe Soss, professor and Coles Chair for the Study of Public Service at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. We discuss Joe's forthcoming book, written with Richard Fording and Sanford Schramm, called Disciplining the Poor, Neoliberal Paternalism and the Persistent Power of Race. In our conversation, as in the book, Joe traces the tremendous continuities as well as the major changes that have occurred in welfare provision and poverty governance in the United States over the past 40 years. Stay tuned as we learn how racial, political, and economic factors have shaped welfare policies in the U.S., and how what it might really take to address poverty in the long run is more democracy. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Good. Great. Well, you have a book coming out soon with a couple of your collaborators, Richard Fording and Sanford Schramm. And so it's called Disciplining the Poor, and I thought I'd just start out by asking you how this book came about. How did you guys get started on this project?
Well, Sandy and I met when I was still a graduate student, actually, and he came and visited at the University of Wisconsin, and I sat in on a seminar of his that he taught on the welfare state and welfare policy, and we pretty quickly began writing together, and we did a number of different articles on different things, and over time really developed a coherent set of interests that that we realized at some point Richard Fording was really pursuing as well. And so Sandy was actually the first to finally meet Richard, and then he introduced us, and we immediately started talking about working together. And the initial idea, actually, for the project was that we were just going to try and look at some issues around how this new approach to dealing with poverty in the United States was really operating on the ground. And so the project really started in a bottom-up way. We started out going, we wanted to get some administrative data and also go do some field visits to look in the state of Florida, which was really pursuing a strong form of the new approaches to poverty governance, really look at what was going on down there and how things were operating. And because we all shared an interest in race and its role in poverty politics, we were particularly interested in how race operated within that new system. And once we began to look on the ground and began to analyze the administrative data some, we began to see a lot of things that really resonated with some of the other work that we were doing and had done that we weren't thinking of as part of the same thing, really. But that was really on why states were choosing the policies they were and what was going on nationally with public opinion. And we began to see a much larger and more coherent story coming together, that there seemed to be the same sorts of things operating in similar ways at different levels of the system. And eventually, after working on several pieces of this in different articles, we decided to step back and turn it into a book-length project.
Wow. That's a lot. And you guys certainly do in the book bring together a lot of different, both broad national historical and then also stuff from your case in Florida. And so the book is really quite comprehensive.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things we're attempting to do in the book is that the book is rooted in the idea that there's been a really significant shift in some ways in the way we deal with poverty in the United States. There is a lot of continuity between the current ways we handle poverty and address poverty and centuries of efforts to do that. And we're impressed by that continuity, and we actually write quite a bit about it and see it as just as important as the changes. But we also see the change as being meaningful, and it's the interplay of those two things that really defines the current system. And so we set out in the book really to do what we couldn't do in the shorter articles, which was to really present one broad analysis that explained why we got the directions of change when we did, and then what the nature of those changes are and how the system operates today, and then to understand the consequences of that for people. And the only way to really do that, we thought in the end, was to write a little broader book than most people normally do, instead of focusing looking at one particular aspect of policy or politics, say public opinion or what happens in the legislature or one particular level, like national change or the states, we really decided to follow this broad question of poverty governance down from the historical changes at the national level into the states to find out why things took different forms in right. different states and why we really didn't get one thing. We got many different things.
Right.
And then down within a state, Florida in our case, to look at how these policies were then implemented and how they varied across counties and workforce regions, ultimately going down into the field research we do inside service providing organizations and all the way down to looking at the individual level interactions between, say, welfare case managers and the clients themselves to try and look at what this means in practice.
Yeah, wow. That's great. So something I wanted to ask you about, just for people that maybe don't know as much about welfare history, I know we've talked some about that continuity that you mentioned. And so what are the things that people should know that has just kind of always been the case about welfare in the U.S.? Like, what are those great continuities that you guys...
Yeah. So, you know, welfare provision in the United States has always had some fairly important characteristics. One is that it's always been provided in a way that is designed to not create what in contemporary language people like to call work disincentives.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, it's been designed around what some people call the principle of less eligibility,
right.
Which is a term brought over from England. But it's essentially the idea that there's an obligation to help the poor and to provide assistance to those in need, but that assistance should always be provided in a way that does not make them really or even apparently better off than the people working the worst, lowest paying jobs in the economy. So benefits traditionally are kept well below the kinds of wages that are offered in those lowest jobs. Those benefits are not easy to get. There are administrative runarounds that pose mm-hmm. barriers. And of course, one of the things that most people know about welfare, if they know anything, is that it's highly stigmatized. And so even if the benefits are accessible and relatively close to what the lowest wages would be, people would resist wanting to get them because of the stigma associated. You know, all of those elements remain very important to how welfare is provided today. And it's also the case that welfare today, you know, has some connections to historical patterns of provision in the United States in that it's dispersed across the federal system. It's a state and local, there's a lot of state and local variation. It's not new for the government to be partnering in various ways with organizations and civil society and even in the market in providing welfare. And it's also not new in any way for welfare programs to be rooted in images of recipients that are not just generally degrading, but also distinctive in terms of different racial and ethnic groups that are gendered, that play on various differences in society, and really in some respects create different policies for different groups, especially in terms of their implementation. None of that is new, and anyone who has really spent some time looking into the history of welfare and the provision in the United States will not find anything new about the fact that welfare programs today are designed to regulate behavior, to reform people,
right.
To get them to take on certain types of behavior that are considered more moral or more consistent with what one is supposed to do as a member of society in some way.
Right. Okay, good. So in describing what's different, or just in the course of your book, you guys bring in this big term, neoliberal paternalism, and it's really important in understanding your guys' argument, but I thought maybe you could explain to us what is that neoliberal paternalism.
Yeah, so we use this term neoliberal paternalism, which we're not the first to have used. There are other scholars who have as well. But we define it in a particular way that I think is important. Essentially, our argument is that if you want to understand the direction of change historically in poverty governance in the United States, you have to see it as occurring at the intersection of really two movements that have changed policy and politics in the U.S. One is neoliberalism. And neoliberalism is a form of what we call market fundamentalism, meaning that in many ways it places the state and lots of other social relations, makes them subordinate to the market. You know, the real confusion here about neoliberalism is that many people recognize it as a form of market fundamentalism, but see what's happening now as a repetition of past attempts to essentially scale back the state, free the market. So laissez-faire forms of market fundamentalism have historically involved what some people think of as libertarian arguments, but the idea of sort of making the state smaller so that markets will naturally flourish and so that people will naturally find, you know, gravitate toward engaging in market relations, that it's really the distortions of the state that are the problem for markets and free relations in the market. The difference with neoliberalism is that it's really not so much, although we continue to see many efforts to scale back the state in certain arenas, it's not so much about scaling back the state as a whole, and in fact it hasn't rolled back the activist state in broad terms. It's really about changing the way in which the state carries out its business, reorganizing the state itself around market principles, and redirecting the state to actually serve market needs in various ways. And so today we see that the state is used to open up markets, it's used to construct market relations, used to absorb market losses, like through the bailouts and a variety of other issues that are currently very controversial in terms of the Occupy Wall Street movement, that the state is far from pulling back from its obligations in terms of being active in the economy, has expanded its activities. So the state is actively involved for the poor in attempting to move people into the market, in attempting to immerse people into market experiences so that they will learn to conduct themselves in ways that are needed to be employees. It engages in also, sort of builds these classes for people, and it creates incentives for people to go into the market. It creates tax subsidies for employers to hire them, and wage supplements to make people able to survive, albeit in a very subsistence way, on the low wages they receive. It creates transitional supports so that people are no longer either getting government benefits or in the market. They actually are taking many of those benefits into the marketplace with them as employees. And on the other side, the market is being drawn into these welfare programs so that when you go into a welfare program today, you're not being relieved of those market pressures, as in the old principle of less eligibility. You're not being relieved of those market pressures alone because you're stepping outside. Actually, you're entering into a program that requires you to put in work hours, that draws employers in and holds job fairs of various sorts. In fact, if you go to the average workforce region website in Florida today, what you'll read is repeated statements that we see ourselves as having two clienteles. The employers, local employers, are considered the clientele of the welfare agency as much, and in some cases I would argue even more, than the poor families that are receiving the benefits officially themselves. So it's really, they're really working as workforce intermediaries, market institutions. So there's this very basic blurring of the state and market operations, with all these operations sort of being reorganized to reflect market values and to serve market needs. So that's the neoliberal side, and it is really, you can sort of see it in a variety of concrete developments, particularly the devolution of policy authority from central authorities at the national level down to more state and local actors, the privatization of whether it's, Corrections Corporation of America on the incarceration side, or Blackwater in military operations, or trash pickup in St. Paul today, or the various kinds of corporations that today are involved in providing welfare for a profit. And then thirdly, the other concrete manifestation of this is really the rise of these competitive performance systems that really put all welfare providers into almost a quasi-market set of relations where they're getting contracted to provide these services. They're expected to perform in a certain way. They need to do better than other providers, and they are rewarded or punished in financial terms for their performance, much like corporate actors in the marketplace. So all that's neoliberalism. Paternalism arose arose at the same time, in a sense, as a reform movement in poverty governance. And paternalism, of course, as the name suggests, is really modeled on the traditional father-child kind of authority relationship, right, with the idea that the father has an obligation to guide and help the child, because the child, in a sense, is not able to recognize what's in their interests, or if they recognize it, don't have the self-discipline needed to bring their behavior in line with their good intentions.
Right.
And so the father at various times needs to set the agenda for what the child needs to do, in this view, needs to punish behavior that deviates from those expectations, needs to reward and incentivize better behavior, needs to monitor behavior at all times. And so the paternalist approach to poverty governance really emphasizes a sort of directive and supervisory relationship of state administrative institutions over the poor. And as paternalism rose in the contemporary United States, it's important to realize that it sort of came into being as part of the broader movement known as neoconservatism. And neoconservatism is really about developing a strong state, not weakening the state as it lies here, but developing a strong state and a state that will put its strength to use for moral purposes. We're familiar with this oftentimes in foreign interventions of various sorts, but its domestic side is equally important, and it really has been an important part of the movement to shift poverty governance toward a model where the state is seen as having a fundamental responsibility to cultivate social order, to ensure social order in poor communities, and to also instill self-discipline in individuals from those communities. And we see this rise of paternalism in both the criminal justice system and the rise of mass incarceration in the United States, and the variety of changes in policing and criminal justice that we have, and also on the welfare side, where we see a new model of sort of providing aid on the basis of expectations and monitoring, and then penalties for non-compliance and incentives for positive compliance.
Right. One of the things that you brought up a couple of times, and I also wanted to ask you about, is this interplay now between the welfare state and corrections. And you guys address this, you know, very head-on in the book. And, you know, Louis Laquant, you know, has written on this, and you guys are responding and working with his work on that. So talk a little bit more about that, and maybe some of what you found in the book and in the research on that interplay, and how you guys define that.
Yeah, our work has a real debt to Louis Vicomte's work, and we've benefited greatly from reading his work. We have some significant disagreements with that work, one of them being that he, in terms of neoliberal paternalism, what I was just describing, that he tends to treat the relationship between neoliberal paternalism is that neoliberalism is about rolling back the state and doing less in terms of the economic and social functions of the state, and that creates disorders that then the paternalists, particularly the penal aspects of the state through incarceration, sort of mop up. They control and contain the disorder that occurs when you roll back the social and economic activities of the state. We put them together a bit differently. But one of the areas where we really agree with Vicomte, and I think elaborate and I'll put some empirical meat on the bones of his argument in some ways, is in this area of saying that incarceration and criminal justice, more broadly policing, and all of that really operates side by side with the welfare system today as a kind of double regulation of the poor. So if you go back several decades, or more, to the period before the rise of mass incarceration, incarceration rates and more broadly rates of correctional control, including parole and probation in the United States, were pretty low relative to now, certainly, and affected relatively small portions of low-income communities. And really much of the sort of efforts to promote work and promote compliance with various social expectations really occurred much more through the welfare state and the public assistance programs that targeted the poor. But that has all changed. I mean, the policy changes that we have pursued in the last several decades have made the criminal justice system much more important, both in the fact that it has become much more muscular, and the fact that it now affects, you know, a much higher proportion of low-income population
right.
of the United States, not just the people who pass through it, but their families and their social networks and their broader communities.
Right.
So the question is, how do you think about these things and their relationship to one another? One thing we can say, you know, off the bat is that they actually, although they target the same communities, they actually are targeted at different parts of those communities in a gender sense.
Mm-hmm.
That about 90% of the people who are receiving benefits from a program like what most people consider welfare in the United States, the TANF program, for example,
right.
are women.
Right.
The adults, at
mm-hmm.
least, not the children. And about 90% of the adults who are incarcerated are men.
Right.
Even though rates of incarceration for women are rising at a faster rate than for men right now, and we're seeing some closure of that, it's still a vast difference.
Right.
So there's some gender targeting here that's very important for understanding the differences between the system. But we make the argument that essentially there's been a convergence of these systems in ways that go beyond just the fact that they both changed at the same time,
right.
and beyond the fact that they target the same communities.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we argue in the book and provide evidence in the book that many of the very same factors predict variations across the states
mm-hmm.
In terms of why we see tougher versions of criminal justice policies, tougher versions of welfare policies. Those things tend to move together
right.
And in response to the same sorts of forces, just as many of the national campaigns to create changes in one drew on the same kind of rhetorics and were made by many of the same actors and funded by some of the same interests as the changes that happened on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond those sort of origins and the factors that the forces that sort of shape these policies, the policies themselves really have begun to follow some similar logics. Now, that's not entirely new
mm-hmm.
because in the past, of course, we went through several decades of a very significant rehabilitation emphasis in prison programs
right.
that linked what was happening in welfare, in the welfare mm-hmm. state, brought that into the carceral state.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But what has happened is that there's been in some ways a reversal of that influence
mm-hmm.
as mass incarceration has become the norm in the United States. Today, those rehabilitation programs are much smaller.
Yeah.
And in welfare programs today, we see many of the logics and languages from criminal justice have been imported
mm-hmm.
and are now a crucial part. So the whole logic of a set of expectations that when violated results in penalties,
right.
Today is a fundamental part of how welfare programs are run.
Yeah.
If you look at, people have always cycled in and out of welfare programs, going into low-wage jobs that turn out to be unsustainable and then returning to welfare programs for a while and then
yeah.
moving out.
Mm-hmm.
But today that cycling is analyzed and discussed through a language of recidivism,
right.
typically that's drawn from the criminal justice
huh.
domain. Felony convictions of various sorts can be used to block people from eligibility for aid on one side, and welfare programs on the other side in many cases are used for sting operations now
yeah.
To attempt to get people with outstanding warrants in order to apply criminal penalties. The systems operate in many respects, not just in terms of a shared logic, but also through sharing of information and,
yeah.
and a variety of other things. So, at all levels of the system, we would argue that there's some connection between the two. And
mm-hmm.
empirically, we find that the two tend to track together. So the
mm-hmm.
states with the toughest welfare programs tend to be the states with the highest levels of correctional control.
Mm-hmm.
The counties with the highest level of racial disparities in who gets sanctioned in welfare programs tend to be the same counties, on average, that tend to produce higher racial disparities in arrest rates.
Mm-hmm.
There are a variety of kinds of dynamics
mm-hmm.
that we can track together
mm-hmm.
and some sense. The last thing I'd say about that also that I think is important to realize is that when most people think about high levels of incarceration in the United States, they tend to think about people being imprisoned and being in prison.
Yeah, that's very true.
And, of course, in many prisons today, particularly supermax prisons and some of the higher security ones, there's not much rehabilitation. There's not much attempt to, move people into, behaving differently or any of those things as you see in welfare programs. Although we do see requirements in some cases for work.
Right.
Or we do see in prison, there's quite a prison industry sector which is very, very much part of this neoliberalism that we talk about in parallel to the required work in welfare programs. But the problem with thinking primarily about who's in prison at a given moment is that the majority of people who are under correctional control in this country are people in probation and parole.
Right.
And so really, mass incarceration is not so much about all these people being warehoused as cycling people through prisons and then into parole programs. And when you look at what's happening already in many parole programs, but even beyond that, the sort of direction of change that people are pursuing with reentry programs and things like that, what we're seeing is an effort to apply on that side, particularly to the men coming out, the same kinds of technologies, the same kinds of program designs that have been used on the welfare side. And in fact, some of the people pushing that most forcefully are some of the same actors and scholars who pushed it on the welfare side initially. So there's, again, is this kind of feeding back from one to the other.
Yeah, and you brought up race and racial disparities, and I wanted to make sure we talk about that because that's obviously very central in the book, and you guys use a particular model for looking at race, the racial classification model of policy choice. That was a mouthful, but I got it out.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that model and how you guys use it, maybe both as you're looking at things at the national historical level, but then maybe we can get a little bit more into Florida and kind of the more on-the-ground piece and how you guys saw race operating there.
Sure. There's a puzzle here, in some ways, or not a puzzle, a problem, a real problem, here of trying to understand how it is that we can observe such tremendous racial inequalities and racial disparities in treatment under the cover of official public policy.
Right.
In an era in which it is illegal to make racial distinctions and design different types of treatment for different groups in the letter of the law.
Right.
In an era in which the vast majority of people in the United States tend to endorse, at least on the surface, norms of racial equality, or perhaps it's a little safer or right, more correct to say, tend to have a negative view of anyone who does not actively endorse that. And in which also a very significant change has happened in many of the institutions of poverty governance, in that a lot of the people who are working the jobs that deal with poor populations are no longer the sort of stereotype of a white middle class person taking, dealing with poor, often minority populations. There's been a tremendous influx of people of color into these institutions. And so there's these real questions about how is it that we're producing the kind of racial disparities that we find and other people find in many instances. And our approach to understanding this is to begin from the premise that really it's not explained by that old image that people like to fall back on, which still has some truth to it. And there are many instances where there's a problem, but, you know, of the sort of white people who have conscious prejudice and in a sense intentionally discriminate against people who are not part of their own group, a kind of conscious us-them dynamic, favoring those who are part of your own racial group or ethnic group and acting negatively toward those who threaten you or you're less familiar with in some sense from the out-group. That just doesn't explain things very well in the context that we're looking at. So what's going on? Well, we take what we understand to be basically be a structural view of race. And we begin from the idea that race operates in a way that it structures social relations, right? It's an important part of our politics, for example. People's understandings of the parties and the kind of competition that we see between the political parties in the United States, for example, is aligned with the racial dimension of politics. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are understood as having different positions on racial policy issues, and also on many of the social problems that people associate with, for example, the quote-unquote urban underclass.
Right.
And so race, not only in terms of who votes for whom, but also in terms of the very structure of competition in our politics, just to cite one example, is structured around race. The economy also, economic relations, are structured in important ways around race, because race matters so greatly for where people live and the extent to which they're segregated in where they live, for the kind of education and human capital they acquire, for the kind of opportunities they have available to them in the market. We have in many ways racially structured labor markets. So because race matters so much for both politics, political relations, and economic relations, it is, in a sense, inevitable that race will matter for this set of institutions that govern poverty, that in a sense, a very real sense, is just a creature of our political life together and our economic life together. It's constructed and will always, to some degree, reflect those relations. And so to the extent that race structures those relations, is going to matter for poverty governance as well. But at the same time that we think it's you have to deal with race as a social structure, you also have to take the step of asking how is it that it actually affects what the way people think about these issues, the decisions people make, and the actions they take. Because ultimately, the outcomes we get are not simply pure products of social structure. Human agency matters a lot.
Right.
People act within those social structures, and they're not determined in how they act. And
so, not robots.
They're not robots. And so we want to understand how race ultimately matters. And if we're saying that we can't really understand that well through this model of intentional discrimination and prejudice, what's going on? And the argument that we make is that when people attempt to design policy or implement policy, they tend to do so in a way where they think about the actors that they're applying the policy to and try to figure out what might work. And that their impressions about what might work, is this a group that really isn't doing what we want because they don't have the opportunity? Or is this a group that isn't doing what we want because they don't have the motivation and they need incentives to do it? Is this a group that would only respond to threats and punishments? Or in some, you know, what is it that we need for this group? Is this a group that just can't really control themselves, you know, and we need to help them actually bring their behaviors in line with what they want, whatever it is. That as people look at groups that they're designing policies for or applying policies for, too, then that what they do, in a sense, is they have limited information about those groups. And one of the things that they often have access to is racial information, right? They can identify that we're talking about a primarily Latina group here, or African-American group, or they know the race or ethnicity of the person that they're dealing with in an administrative setting or whatever it is, and that they use a kind of what academics call a heuristic reasoning, what psychologists call heuristic reasoning, in that they take small amounts of information they have and they extrapolate from that, and they fill in the details in some sense. And our model basically draws on a set of research in that's come from psychology and sociology that is often referred to as implicit racism theory or implicit cognitive theory, that suggests that a lot of this goes on behind the curtain, in a sense, that people are not aware that they're doing this in many cases, but that they look at who they're designing a policy for, or implementing it for, and they make judgments about what is needed. They make judgments about, in implementation settings, whether a certain behavior indicates a real problem or is a one-time thing. They have to make these judgments, and there's nothing wrong with making those judgments, but race is a potential basis for those judgments. And we argue that in some cases, more than others, people are likely to draw on race in mm-hmm. making those judgments, and as a result, we see racial biases emerge in those. So you asked about the implementation setting.
Yeah.
You know, a good example here is that some people may be aware of some work that Deva Pager, a sociologist, did.
Yeah.
Where she looked at, she did hiring audits, essentially, to look at the interplay of race and a felony drug conviction on the likelihood that someone would be hired for a job.
Uh-huh.
And what she found was that if you had essentially someone going out and applying for the job who was identical, except one was white, one was black,
mm-hmm.
and then among those, one white person had male, had a had a criminal conviction, one did not, and then the black
right.
male had a conviction and not, that really the biggest effect, you know, in terms of a negative outcome, suppressing the likelihood of being hired, was when you combine the criminal conviction, right, attach the criminal conviction, that discrediting marker, to the African American male.
Right.
And we drew from that the idea that it's important to think about race as a source of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not always the case that white clients and black clients in a welfare program are going to be treated differently,
mm-hmm.
but that under certain conditions that will emerge
mm-hmm.
much more strongly. And the racial classification model is an attempt to specify those conditions.
Okay.
So, for example, in the book we find, consistent with Pager's work, that when we did an experiment
right.
with case managers, and then we corroborated this with administrative data, that when you attach to someone's record, first in a hypothetical vignette, then in the actual administrative
mm-hmm.
data, when you attach to that record a note saying that this person has a prior sanction on their record,
mm-hmm.
right, that has no discernible statistical effect on the likelihood that a white client will be sanctioned. White
mm-hmm.
clients would not be sanctioned at a greater rate just because they had that prior sanction on their record. But for black clients, we find a tremendous increase in
okay.
the likelihood that they'll be sanctioned. Or to take another example, people are sanctioned, penalties are applied to them in welfare programs more often in conservative regions, politically conservative regions, than
mm-hmm.
in liberal regions.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at data from public opinion surveys in the United States, what you find is that negative stereotypes of African Americans and to some extent Latinos relative to white Americans run much higher among conservatives than among liberals. So the implication we draw from that is that that effect of shifting from being in a liberal region to a conservative region should be much greater for minority clients. And in fact, that's what we find, that for white clients, it doesn't really matter that much whether they pursue welfare benefits and participate in a very conservative region or a liberal region, but for black clients in particular, that we see a very large increase in the likelihood of being sanctioned you know, when you move to a conservative region.
Yeah.
Or a last example, one of the great stereotypes and racialized stereotypes of welfare in the United States is the idea that poor African Americans are more likely to prefer to stay on welfare for a long period of time and avoid work,
mm-hmm.
right, in some sense, relative to white Americans. And so taking that aspect of racial difference, we hypothesize that the longer people's spells become, the longer they stay in a welfare program, the more that gap should emerge with a gap between the rates at which white clients are sanctioned and black clients are sanctioned. And in fact, that's just what we find.
Huh.
Early on, the differences are quite small and even statistically insignificant in the first months. But by the time you get out toward a year of participation in a welfare program, this gap has emerged, with black clients much more likely to get sanctioned than white clients. And we think, again, consistent with the other findings, that this is because they in a sense, their record gives a stereotype consistent cue that seems to confirm the expectation that this person will be a problem in some sense. They now look like the long-term welfare recipient of stereotyping lore, much like the person who has the prior sanction on their record now looks like more of a problem client if they're a person of color.
Mm. Okay. Wow. And just to clarify for anyone who doesn't know what a sanction is, because there's there's a range, right, of what those can entail. So yeah. Just tell us a little bit about welfare sanctions.
Yeah, so sanctions are essentially financial penalties for noncompliance. Mm-hmm. They're, in a sense, the policy tool that puts teeth behind all the requirements, whether it be requirements to attend meetings with a case manager, to document your work activities and pursue your work activities, whatever they may be. That sanctions are there to impose a penalty on the person. Mm-hmm. If they don't do that. From a paternalist perspective, sanctions essentially are a way of using state authority. Mm-hmm. To hopefully teach the client a lesson by showing them that their actions are being observed, and that when they don't meet expectations, they will be punished, and that hopefully in some sense they will learn to behave, to right their behavior and discipline themselves in the mm-hmm. future. From a neoliberal perspective, sanctions are oftentimes understood as a market wage deduction, the argument being that if a person was in a job and they didn't show do what they were supposed to in their job, they would lose wages, mm-hmm. maybe even lose their job. And so the idea is people wanted to design welfare programs to have that dynamic so that the person was experiencing quote-unquote market realities already within the welfare program. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. States had under welfare reform, which was passed at the federal level in 1996, states had to adopt some sort of sanction policy.
Okay.
But they could adopt different types of sanction policies. Some adopted a kind of progressive policy where the penalty would be quite small at first, or there would be no penalty on the first infraction, and then it would grow over mm-hmm. time. They could apply the penalty just to the adult, keeping children's benefits available to the children, so it would be a partial deduction in a mm-hmm. sense of the check. And then, you know, some states adopted the harshest form of penalty, which was full family sanction, the entire check, and immediate removal of that assistance, the whole amount on the first infraction.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in Florida, where we were studying, this is not only the cash check that they lose, but also food stamp benefits.
Oh, really?
As well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. And so you guys did look at that. I remember now from the book, you looked nationally across the states and how different states adopted these different levels of more punitive kind of policies. And so what were some of the factors that contributed, you know, in terms of like politics and race and things yeah. like that, as to whether or not states adopted?
Yeah. Well, it's the most important factor in terms of the adoption of sanction policies after 1996 was the race of the welfare population.
Okay.
So states that had welfare populations that included higher percentages
mm-hmm.
Of African Americans, and to a lesser extent, but still a significant extent, Latinos,
mm-hmm.
Tended to adopt tougher sanctions.
Hmm.
And one of the things that we show in the book, and that is an important theme of the book, is the accumulation of racial biases. There are all of these sort of areas where you can find small to medium-sized racial biases in different choices.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look across the levels of the system, or even if you look at one level of the system at different policy choices that are being made, they tend to accumulate in ways that wind up creating very large disparities.
Hmm.
Between racial and ethnic groups. So in this case, for example, you can take sanctions and go down the system and say, well, you know, African Americans tend to live in states with tougher sanction policies because, of course, that was a major predictor of which states chose
right.
The tougher policies to begin with. And then when you look down in terms of implementation, not only are they disproportionately located in states with tougher sanction policies, they're disproportionately likely to be sanctioned
right.
in various ways, you know, under certain conditions, as I was describing before.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we show toward the end of the book is that actually the negative effects of being sanctioned, which we show that for all groups, being sanctioned has negative effects
mm-hmm.
on their earnings and what happens once they leave the welfare program. But the negative effects of being sanctioned are actually much larger for clients of color than
mm-hmm.
for white clients. So there's this compounding
right.
Right, of things down the system. If you look across at one level, if you look at the states and just look at the different policies they choose, and look not only at sanctions, but also other things like how short lifetime time limits on welfare receipt are, or how tough the work requirements are, or whether there's a family cap policy which says that if you have a child while you're on welfare, that you have to have the same level of check. You can't get additional benefits for that child. If you look at all these policies, there are these racial biases in the selection of each policy. And if you combine them to sort of look at states as having a kind of policy regime, what you find is there are these huge racial disparities between the most lenient regimes measured according to these different policies and the toughest ones.
Okay.
Right? Now, what's interesting about the fact that race was such a strong predictor, and alone as such a strong predictor after 1996 when welfare reform passed, was it was a bit of an anomaly in terms of the historical record.
Huh.
In most of the other periods, race was a very important factor. But if you look back from the 60s through the 90s, and if you look you know, in the 2000s at what was going on with implementation in the different states, what you find is it's not just race. It's also the sort of political economy kind of factors. And in particular, we focus on two things repeatedly through the book. One is partisan control. Of government, whether it be state legislatures and governors, or it is the prevailing politics, partisan and ideological leanings of a local county and implementation. What we find is that more conservative and more Republican control tends to lead to tougher policy choices, tends to lead to more incarceration, tends to lead to you know, more sanctioning in welfare programs, all of these sorts of things. But then also that interacts with race, right? So that you see different outcomes for different racial groups. And then the thing that we look at on the economic side is conditions in the low-wage labor market. So I talked earlier about the principle of less eligibility and the idea that there's a sort of, if you want to understand what's going on in welfare programs, you need to pay attention to this relationship between prevailing wages for the lowest skilled workers, right, and the welfare benefits that are being offered. And what we find repeatedly in our analyses is that where you get welfare benefits that are encroaching on wages for low-skilled workers, which was very easy for welfare benefits to do because wages were declining so rapidly for low-skilled workers, that even though welfare benefits were also declining, they tended to stick pretty close to each other. And that where you see this kind of benefit-wage ratio, as we call it, with the benefits close to the wages edging up toward them, you tend to see these much tougher approaches to welfare, and you tend to see more cuts in the size of welfare benefits, but you also tend to see a greater effect again of race, because again, the as welfare benefits and wages come to look like each other, anxieties are raised about the issue, and the salience of the issue is raised for concerns for the idea that people are going to prefer welfare over working. And that tends to cue greater concerns about stereotypes of racial minorities as preferring welfare over work, and laziness stereotypes. And as a result, we tend to see even tougher approaches when that tends to happen. So in general, we tend to see these three things fit together, a kind of racialized political economy approach with political control, you know, conditions in low-wage labor markets, and the racial composition of the groups or individuals that policy is being applied to. Right? The interesting thing is that the only period where those three things don't interact in those ways is that period right after welfare reform. And I think the answer to that anomaly is that this was a period of tremendous, you know, public discourse around welfare that was highly racialized and brought race to the fore, at the same time that what was really going on politically was that centrist Democrats, moderate Democrats, from the Democratic Leadership Council, and particularly in the Bill Clinton administration, were really getting on board with getting tougher with both on the criminal justice side and on the welfare side. And so we were getting a bipartisan kind of convergence, which right after welfare reform tended to drain out the differences that used to be there, depending on which party was in control of state government. And also the sort of moral fervor to do something about the underclass, and the idea that there was just this pathological set of problems, ranging from teen pregnancy to substance abuse to criminality, sort of broad social disorder, as people perceived it in urban ghettos, that in a sense detached policymaking in the states from any objective realities of differences in terms of their labor markets or other types of social conditions. So that people were really just responding to the idea that something had to be done about this terrible threat. And I think the one sort of predictor that we observed there, race, reflects the fact that it was a fundamentally racialized understanding of what the problem was.
Wow, fascinating. Well, to bring us to kind of a conclusion here, I thought maybe I'd turn to, you guys offer some suggestions at the end of the book about kind of where welfare could go from here, or maybe ideally, you know, and I thought I'd ask you maybe just to talk a little bit about those suggestions, and then, you know, obviously we're in a very particular political atmosphere right now with a lot of, you know, slash and burn of various programs, but then we also have these protests going on right now with Occupy Wall Street. So it's a very interesting climate that we have out there. So maybe talk a little bit about your suggestions, and then how you see, you know, issues of welfare and poverty governance playing into the political climate that we have right now.
Sure. I'll try to be brief. The first thing that we say about attempts to make things better is that a central lesson of our work and of other people's work, like Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward's work in regulating the poor, is that really these approaches to poverty governance are fundamentally embedded in and shaped by political relations and economic relations. And that there's no magic policy design. There's no way to design a policy that is going to serve low-income people well, so long as we don't deal with the underlying issues about the sort of weakening of democracy in the United States and the racial dimensions of our politics and gender dimensions of all those sorts of things. And there's no way to design good poverty policies really that are going to overcome problems in the market unless we deal with the fact that jobs are not designed to allow for caring obligations, right? And they're not designed for people, disproportionately women, who have small children and obligations to take care of those small children, or obligations to take care of elderly parents, or have disability issues that they're dealing with. So long as the basic structures of the economy, the market, and in our politics look those ways, the line that we say in the book is that, you know, bad poverty policies can be bad under any circumstances, but good poverty policies can only be as good as the underlying social relations that they serve. So we really can't divorce the effort to change poverty policy and poverty governance from the kind of broad efforts at reform that we see in the Occupy Wall Street movements today, and various things like that. We have to understand that these things are intimately related, and you really have to deal with the whole in some respects. But within that, I think it's also important and I think we kind of owe it to the readers, after taking them through this long critical analysis, to offer some ideas about what better policies would look like. And much of what we argue in that regard is that there are certain aspects of what's wrong with the current system that really can be improved through central national policies, through national controls. So, for example, a lot of the racial inequalities that we observe would not be possible without a devolved you know, system of federalism where choices are being made in different places according to the racial characteristics of populations.
Mm-hmm.
We also think there are a lot of dynamics that suggest that benefit levels ought to be set at the federal level for the poor. There ought to be, you know, federal child care policies and transportation policies to assist people in various ways. But that ultimately our argument is that federalism really can play an important role and localism can play an important role, even though we observe mainly negative effects from those things in the book. We think it's the way it's been designed, not necessarily inherent to the system. So what we argue at the end of the book is that we need to have meaningful federal floors, whether it be minimum wage laws or federal benefit levels for the poor for assistance or, you know, various services and supports. But that states and localities should be able to rise above those floors and attempt to provide greater services and supports in various ways, but not fall below them.
Okay.
But that also there's a set of issues that really, once you establish that those sort of foundations at the federal level, really can be handled at the local level and should be. Because people ought to be able to have the opportunity to govern themselves in different ways in different localities, different states. But the argument that we make is that ultimately, like many of the problems having to do with the financial crisis and, you know, many of the issues that are at the heart of protest movements right now, are actually, much like the problems in poverty governance, problems of democracy. They're problems of insufficient democratization.
Okay.
And we argue in many respects that rather than this sort of top-down paternalist imposition of expectations and punishments and incentives, that we really need to think about poverty programs as being a site where people are really addressing the most fundamental issues in their lives. They have a lot to say about what their problems are. They have a lot to add to the discussion of what kinds of benefits they need individually and what their communities need in order to flourish. And that we really need to design programs around a much more democratic set of values that draws people into the process. And in saying that, we actually partly maybe agree with some arguments made by paternalists who say that there ought to be not just rights, but also obligations. We don't argue that people ought to have, you know, rights to all sorts of things from other citizens and not have any obligations for that.
Right.
Our point is that all people, when they are treated as full citizens, and I use this term in the membership sense, not making a distinction between people who have legal citizenship and those who don't,
okay.
or incorporate residents who don't have legal citizenship in this. But when you treat people as full members of society in a citizenship sense, you ask them to shoulder both rights and obligations. And I think that people in poverty programs ought to have rights to due process and substantive rights to various types of supports, but they also ought to have obligations to contribute to the running of those programs, to governing themselves. They ought to have the responsibility to not just be the sort of governed creatures of those programs, but also participate in the creation of those programs and their design. And I think that when, I think the evidence shows actually that when you have program designs like that, that people actually benefit from them. One of the things that I've studied in the past is the contrast between cash welfare programs, which have these very paternalist designs, and Head Start programs, which have these participatory parents' councils where people have obligations to join together to talk about how the center is going to be run for their children. And what we find is that, of course, even though Head Start is in many ways designed for the children, that people who, parents who become involved with these participatory councils and Head Start programs become more, have higher levels of civic engagement and political engagement as a result, and also they actually do better economically. They tend to have, there tend to be positive effects on their outcomes in the labor market as well. So in some ways, in giving people obligations that empower them is very different from and more positive than the kind of brand of responsibility that paternalists have argued, which is simply making people responsible for failing to meet the expectations that are being set from above. It's a different notion of responsibility. So we would argue for a system in which we start with broad reforms in terms of political and economic relations. We then attempt to establish various federal floors that guarantee people certain supports and the things they need in order to improve their lives, and then certain types of local control that would allow people to participate in the democratic process of the authorities that are being exercised over their lives.
Hmm.
But ultimately, you know, there is no way to deal with poverty in the United States until we reform the kind of jobs that are available to people with low levels of skill in the United States. Until we change economic relations in this country so that people can have access to jobs that offer wages they can live on, that offer the benefits that they need and their children and their parents need, that offer the kinds of flexibilities that allow for care work and all of those sorts of things, we're not going to have a good fit between the realities of people's lives and the labor market. And there is no set of policies that you can bring in to try and you know, ameliorate the damage of that bad fit that's going to really do the job.
Wow.
So we really have to not think of this as just a quote-unquote welfare policy problem or even a criminal justice problem. We have to think about this as a problem of our most basic relations in the market and in the political system.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your time. This was a great conversation, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, no problem.
That's all for Office Hours this week. Thanks for listening. And if you like these long Office Hours episodes, but wish we would also mix in some shorter episodes now and then, you're in luck. We've got some experimental episode formats coming your way, so stay tuned. See you soon.